Today's episode is kind of special. I've selected five sections from incredible interviews with some pretty amazing women talking about the power of finding your authentic voice and really stepping in to using it so you can make the impact you were put here on earth to make. I think you're going to like this episode, and I don't want you to miss a minute.
Welcome to Captivate the Room with your host, internationally known voice expert, Tracy Goodwin, an award-winning speaker who has taught hundreds around the globe to make a big impact with their voice. This podcast is for anyone who wants to step onto a bigger stage, make a bigger impact, and have a voice that makes people listen. Presentation matters, and the voice is the missing link. Join in and you'll see why.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Tracy Goodwin. And I'm so glad to have you with me today, as always. Thank you so much for your shares and your downloads and for being a subscriber. I love being on this voice journey with you. Now, today I have something very unique for today's episode. I've been wanting to do something like this for a while, and I chose this month to do what I'm doing today. Today I have picked selections from some of my very favorite interviews with some of my very favorite women. Now, I love all the people that come on the show, but because I'm doing this theme of women's history, this is Women's History Month, I'm interviewing women, I'm talking about women's voices, and there are some really amazing interviews I have had with women here on the show. So I went back through all of them, and I really struggled to pick my favorites because I loved them all. But I was thinking about you and what you would probably benefit from hearing the most. And certainly, if you like what you hear from some of these sections, jump over and listen to the whole interview. Some of these interviews are from the early years. Now, before I tell you who I've picked, I just want to let you know really quickly, I think I mentioned this the other day, I am doing a very special program. I've never run this before, and I don't know if I'm going to run it again. I want to try it out. It's a beta test where I'm literally focusing on vocal variety, next level vocal variety. How do you use it? How do you control the conversation with it? Really in-depth work in a very small group, working with vocal variety. Now, the only way you can get information on this to sign up, I have about two, maybe three spots left. Would love for you to reach out to Tracy, T-R-A-C-Y, at CaptivateTheRoom.com. Now, let me tell you about the five, there's five little excerpts from five interviews. The first one is from Dawn Purcell, one of my very favorite interviews. She is the expert in story, and I picked some sections of our interview where she talks about why it's so important for women to share their stories, the power of supporting women, and the history of women being silenced. You have heard me reference her many times, and so I picked three sections from that interview. You're going to love, love, love hearing from her. Then I picked something from my interview with Barbara Barna Abel, who is my casting director friend in New York City. And I picked a section where she's talking about making a bigger impact through practice. Then another favorite interview that I did with Kathy Caprino, really good stuff, where she talks about women thriving and getting out of your own way, as well as perfectionism. And listen, these women are primarily talking about women because they specifically work with women, but there is a whole lot of what they're talking about that relates to every man I work with. So if you're a man, still listen. Then I've got an excerpt from my interview with the gals from the Sparkle Hour, Nicole Lewis Keebler and Michelle Lewis. We had a great interview. And I picked something where we're talking about trauma and really speaking your truth. And then, of course, my last section is with my very dear friend and ever so amazing woman, Mary Grace Sandoval, who is, she came on the show to talk about college and career counseling. She's incredible. She's had an amazing career. Just check her out. She's really something. And I picked the section from the interview where we're talking about perception versus reception, because she talks about that too, similar to how I talk about it. And I also picked some little excerpts from about getting out of your head and interviewing. I think you're going to like these bits. I think you're going to want to probably go check out these episodes. And they run back to back here in today's episode. So take a listen. I think you'll really, really love this compact version of some of this highlight, some of these highlights, but I'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this? Do you want me to do more episodes like this? If so, I totally will. But let's go on over and take a listen to the interviews.
The workshop model works fantastically because a story shared is way more powerful than it just kept inside. And it's always amazing to me how in the workshops, a woman would initially say, because they are really safe, you know, it's a really safe place to be in the workshop. And a woman would initially say, oh, I'm not comfortable in reading out what I've written. And honestly, she would say that for about 5 minutes. And then once all the other women, all it would take is just one woman to read out her journal entry, what she'd just written, and all the other women would follow suit. There's something so powerful about being in a supportive circle that helps women to really find their voice. So I just really loved doing those workshops to see, you know, the women went from, oh, no one can read anything to, oh, I want to read next. I want to read next. It's fantastic.
And what's the benefit of sharing our story?
Oh, wow. It's the benefit of sharing your story is because obviously sometimes we feel like we're really alone in our experience, even though on a cognitive level, on a logical level, our left brain says, yeah, I know other people go through this. We still feel quite isolated. And in many ways, our feelings are unique to us. And yes, our journals are quite personal places. But when you journal at a deeper level, the benefits are twofold. One, it helps you to massively, massively connect with your inner self and your uniqueness and your unique, what I call soul script. But at the same time, the more you do that, the more you connect to self, the more connected you feel to everyone else around you and to the universe and the cosmos and to God. That's, you know, the more you feel connected. So it's just so powerful. So the deeper you go, the more connected you feel, and the vocalizing of that experience takes it to a whole new level. It's like, for example, just to take it to a day-to-day level. Let's say if you have an affirmation, you know, today is a great day. Let's just say that you can write that in your journal, you know, as an affirmation, today is a great day. But when you say that out loud, it takes it up a level. And then when you say it to somebody else, it goes up a level again. So the sharing of it, it just gives it a whole new energy. It massively increases the energy. And it's so cathartic because you've got what's inside on the outside through your voice. And your journal, for a lot of women, I feel, can be a stepping stone. They can write it and explore it before they say it. So it's just really, really powerful for that. A big thing that I'm sort of exploring now with people is the power of myth in our journals, because now I've started working with creative writers, because I'm a writer myself and I've got an MA in creative writing and I'm doing the journaling, and I just thought, I've always kept a journal in order to help my creative writing, and I'm a massive lover of myth and exploring myth and how that can fuel our creative work. But in terms of myth and fairy tales, there's actually a history throughout fairy tales of women being silenced and losing their voice. The Little Mermaid was silenced. The Sleeping Beauty was silenced. Snow White was silenced. There's just a whole history of it. There's another fairy tale by Hans Christian Andersen called Our Lady's Child, in which the woman in that is silenced. And they always have their voice taken away, you know, by other people through no fault of their own, as a punishment or some form of punishment. And the decision to get their voice back again lies with somebody else. And it's as though this... This myth of the archetypical female being voiceless and losing her voice has permeated through to the feminine psyche. So that can really be explored in people's in journals for people who do struggle with speaking their truth. They're afraid of, I don't know, afraid of rejection. I mean, for some people, it's literally... It's not so much that they're afraid of rejection, but they've never got up to speak before, so they're nervous about it. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be at a deep psychological level, but for anyone who has suffered some trauma, or, you know, they're feeling very, very vulnerable for emotional reasons, it does seem to be, you know, perpetuating this myth of somebody losing their voice. So there are lots of different journaling techniques that can be used as well, which, you know, before we end the show today, I can just go over a couple.
You know, it's so interesting that you brought that up, because just last night I'm preparing a new course. And just last night I was doing a little bit of research on some educational materials that I haven't looked over in years. And that was actually in the in the content, how society has silenced women, and it didn't really talk about myth and stories. It talked about, you know, queens and, you know, women in general, and how that's a part of the legacy. And, you know, I've always used that in my teaching, because I deal with different things with women than with men. I work with both, but women tend to have that not using their real voice, and it literally comes down from a lineage. You know, it's really the way that society has established it, that your real voice is worthless. So you've got to, you know, I get women that talk like this, or, you know, won't let their voice out. And so it's a very big thing. It's very big.
Yeah. There's just something like so primal about it. And it has been just, you know, passed on through stories for so long. Like in the early 1800s, in the original story of Sleeping Beauty, she had she speaks up something like 14 times. By the end of the 1800s, with the retelling of the fairy tale, she is silent and she doesn't speak at all. So she's, you know, there's, with each retelling of the story, her voice actually, you know, just goes completely by the end.
Fascinating. I never really realized that until in Little Mermaid. I just directed that show last year.
Right. Yeah. Voice. Yeah. And she, you know, it's this, like with the Little Mermaid, that's particularly interesting, because she gets the choice. You can either have your voice, or you can have love, but you can't have both.
Whoa, that is powerful, Dawn.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, these are so, and it, so much, the thing is with fairy tale and myth, they reach us at a subconscious level. That's what they are expert at doing. You know, that's why they've survived in various incarnations for hundreds of years, because they touch us at a subconscious level.
Yeah.
So that's just one way in which a journal can help a woman to find a voice, is that she can explore her personal myth and say, you know, if she feels like she's punishing herself for something, because she might be doing so and not really be aware of it. But that awareness can come out in, you know, in the journal, sort of what is, you know, where has my voice gone? Why has it gone? Am I punishing myself for this? What do I feel like I'm being punished for? And also in each of the stories, there's always a decision that has to be made as to whether the woman gets her voice back or not.
Mm.
And in many stories, it's somebody else who makes that decision as to whether the woman is going to get her voice or not.
Yeah.
So we can explore our personal myths and decide to take that power back to ourselves and say, I am going to make this decision. And to write that powerfully in somebody's journal and then read it out loud to yourself. And then if you've got a friend or somebody who's willing to listen to you, to read out that journal entry to somebody else. And read it, the reading out of journal entries to other people, it does get much easier every time you do it. And like I say, it does take on such a powerful energy. So I highly recommend it to anybody who is listening to this, to, you know, get a journal buddy.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, love that's that. Great.
And I'm sure you work with them on so many things, but I know that one of the things that you probably really can give my audience some good advice on, that I know they struggle with, is that relaxing and just calming down and you know, being okay. Just chill out. How do we do that? You know, what do your people come to you? They're torqued up, they're worked up, they're worried about the script. Don't take the script. What are the words? I'm not breathing. And I know that's got to be a big piece for you, is to get them to just calm.
So I work, 100%, I work with everyone on centering techniques and breathing.
Mm.
And ways to bring yourself to center. I really encourage people to work on that every day for just a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you work on it every day, it becomes part of your daily practice. You know, you're retraining your brain. I work a lot helping people with visualization.
Mm.
So that you get, because this is just getting your, you know, mind around it. And I've adapted a lot of techniques I was taught from a performance psychologist who works with elite athletes, because this is what they do. And then a timely thing. I mean, I wish I was a fly on the wall for the Super Bowl to hear what happened in the Patriots locker room at halftime. Followed the Super Bowl, but it was, you know, an unprecedented comeback.
Yeah.
That was all mental, calm down. How do we deal with all this crazy adrenaline? But so anyway, so those techniques are adaptable for all of us. So I start with breathing, because as soon as you control your breathing, you've come back to center.
Yeah.
Like you're here now. And so the whole point is learning to those sort of self-soothing techniques. Also adapting from a lot of comedians that I work with, just the sort of little stretches you can do.
Yeah.
Now, these are simple rituals. They take, you know, 2 to 3, 4 minutes. You can do them anywhere. So it doesn't look, you know, if you're self-conscious, it's not something that looks weird. You know, even, you know, power posing. So any of those things that I'm like, encourage people to start adapting now. I do a lot of my best visualization and meditating when I'm in the shower. So I don't have a lot of spare time. So I'm just trying to integrate things into my daily life. I encourage people to do their mirror work while they're putting on makeup or brushing their teeth or shaving.
So
it's not extra time. It's like, how do I maximize
what
I'm doing? But so that's a way just to, because if you come to me the day before a presentation, you're like, I got to deal with my nerves. I'm like, okay, we'll do our best. But that's really, you need to start dealing with that a long time ago. It becomes just part of your practice. And that, you know, really makes a difference. I'm also really trying to encourage people that we're rooting for you. So, right? So it's like, you know, I am a firm believer. We remember the recovery, not the fumble.
Mm.
So, and this is where authenticity starts to make a difference. And sometimes I encourage people to, you know, to own those things or acknowledge the elephant in the room, laugh it off, and keep going. So And being magnetic. And that's where you get people out of the should zone, because of a very tight, narrow box, right? And this fear of failure. The other thing is focus on success, because this gets pretty heavy, but perfectionism is actually an anxiety disorder. So yes, I learned that who is a tremendous resource. I recommend so many of her books and webinars that really help people deal with a lot of these sort of blocks.
Who was that? Brené Brown?
Brené Brown.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Oh, yes. Love her. I'm a follower. I'm a super fan right there. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
So, and that was a big eye opener, really understanding that when you let go of perfectionism and focus on success. And so then we have our checklist, because what does success mean for you in that moment, and everything is situational. And then also some of the things get outside of ourselves, so it's a little easier to sort of handle, because they start to feel tangible and it's no longer swirling in your head. So then we look at, you know, what are your goals? Like for that presentation, what is the goal? Am I here to sell? Am I, you know, I'm trying to get people to buy a book or a product. Am I raising awareness for myself? Am I here to entertain? Am I here to inform? So when you really understand what that goal is, you can start to back into what's the right tone. And then who's my audience? Who am I talking to?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a big one.
And adjusting for who you're doing and what's appropriate within that sphere. Also understanding deeply what's your purpose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how these things interconnect. So we have a checklist of, you know, why you're there, what you're doing. It can get a little bit out of your head. The other thing too is realizing you have the power to be transformative. So get it out of, stop focusing on yourself and start focusing on what you're giving to the other people.
Yes.
So even if it's just like one person in that audience learned something amazing or transformed them or inspired them, you've done your job.
And it right. Wasn't- yeah. Oh, I love that so much. One of the most hurtful things and the most spot on things anybody ever said to me 30 years ago was, Tracy, it's not all about you, you know, and it cut me to the bone, but it was right. It was right. And I love that. And, you know, I just love what you're saying. I mean, I talk about these things, grounding. And I love that you mentioned, because I think that we don't talk about this enough, or some people don't, but there's just this ideology of, I can turn it on. I'm going to go in there and breathe and have it together and pull it. You know, like you said, they come the day before. Let's make this a masterpiece. And we can sure try. But it's a process. It's a laying it into the muscle memory. It's a new, you've locked down your breathing for 32 years. You think you're going to get behind the mic and breathe? Come on. You know, you gotta lay it in. Can you talk about so many great things in there, but one of the things you talk about is hidden crisis that working women face today. Can you share some of that with us?
Yes. Can I give you a bit about how this came about?
Just please.
A 2-minute intro. So as you know, when you read my bio, I had an 18-year corporate career, and it was very successful on the outside, but truly challenged and unsuccessful on the inside. But I didn't understand that. I didn't get it. I thought, okay, this is hard. This is bumpy, but maybe I just have to soldier through. And then when I hit 40, it was full-blown crises. But again, and we're going to talk a lot about women, I'm going to make some generalizations about women. I want everyone to know that I'm not painting every person with the same brush. We're all different. But after a lot of years doing this, I know that women often don't see these challenges for what they are, that they're very large red warning signs that you're in the wrong direction, you're doing the wrong thing with the wrong people. So I tried to get some help, therapy, a career counselor. None of it got me out of that work. Why? Because it was very lucrative. Mm-hmm. And at 40, I thought, well, how do I start over? I don't even understand. I can't conceptualize that. So I didn't leave. And 1 month after moving to a bigger house, more financial burdens, was 9/11. And 1 month later, I was laid off in a way that was so brutal. Mm. And I woke up that day. I was in my therapist's office weeping that week. And he said, listen, I know this is the worst crisis you've ever faced. That's how you see it. How I see it is, it's the first moment you can choose who you want to be. Mm. Who do you want to be? So I really snapped awake. And from that conversation, I became a therapist and a coach. And I started to talk to women around where I live in Connecticut about how do we thrive through change. And I would talk about these challenges, and women would line up, Tracy, after the workshop. And I'm not kidding. They would have tears in their eyes. They would be shaking. And so this is back in 2006, 2007. There wasn't Sheryl Sandberg. There wasn't Lean In. There wasn't Anne Marie Slaughter. It wasn't in the national conversation. Mm-hmm. And women would say, no one is talking about this like you are. I feel like you're inside my head. And I realized, okay, this is like an epidemic. Mm-hmm. And I want to bring new solutions to the table. I want to understand this. So the funny thing about the book is I thought I knew everything about professional crisis. Mm-hmm. So I write a book proposal and I meet with an editorial consultant. She said, listen, this is not your big idea. You really have to research. I said, so to myself, I went, what? And I didn't know what she meant. Like, what do you mean? Go to the library with index cards? What do you mean? But the next day I had an idea. Why don't I talk to 100 women across the country who I don't know, who are not self-selected in my, you know, community about how women get to professional crisis and how we overcome it. And after those 100 interviews, my world was rocked. Mm-hmm. Half of the hypotheses I had were incorrect about what happened. So that's what this book is. To answer your question, what I found is there are 12 common crises and they fall under four levels. Empowerment or disempowerment with yourself, with others, with the world, and with your higher self. So there are things like, I can't speak up because I had that. And every one of these I've lived and every one now I've worked with hundreds of women in these. I can't escape this financial trap. I can't get out of this crushing competition. I can't use my real talents. I can't do work that makes a difference. I can't balance my life and work. So these are the things we hear and see, you know, thousands of times online a day. But when you kind of amalgamate them, you see that these are the common crises working women face. Mm-hmm. And you know what? This came out in 2008. It has not changed.
Wow. These are
the same 12 crises, I think, that I see every day.
Yeah. Yeah. And so fear is a big part of this.
Enormous.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were talking earlier. Somebody said, I teach a coaching certification course, and someone said, so what stops someone from stretching out of their comfort zone? Is it fear? And, you know, you and I know this. People are incredibly complex. Mm-hmm. And when we try to just slap a really easy solution, yeah, it's because, you know, because of blip. It's usually not complex enough, and it's usually not deep enough. But when you look at what holds women back. Now, you have men and women on in your community. Mm-hmm. And I work with great men too, but I do see this with women more. There's a lot of reasons why we're afraid. First of all, most of us were culturally trained not to speak up for ourselves, not to put ourselves first. I mean, even today, there is so much pushback against women. You know, here's an example. I had a client yesterday who said, I just plunked down $4,000 for my son's college education, the tuition payment. And when it comes to me, I can't even spend $200 for myself. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trained, we're conditioned. And then there is pushback. Forceful women in our society are penalized. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just research study after research study. There's gender bias around how we perceive a forceful woman. So when you add all that up, plus we're not really trained to take these steps, which we're going to talk about, you know, from the book, how to look at what I'm wonderful at, what I'm amazingly talented at, and then speak about that. If we can't speak about and stand up for who we really are, we can't move forward, right?
I'm going to come back to the book because I have another question I want to ask, but you said something that I want to ask about because this is something that really resonated with me. Reinvention. Yeah. That reinvention at 40 and 50 and even 60, does that get really tough? And is it doable?
What a fantastic question. So I think it's incredibly doable. One, because I did it at 40 and became a therapist, and because through my courses, my Amazing Career Project and work, this is what I help people do. It is challenging. It's not a walk in the park. Why? Because the very first piece in reinvention is understanding yourself very deeply. Mm-hmm. And that very first step is challenging for people. For instance, I have a career path assessment, which I think, Tracy, you mentioned that's how you learned of me. 11 pages of questions I wish someone had asked me. And if 30 years ago, and if I had answered them, I wouldn't have made the mistakes I made. But you wouldn't believe, after seeing thousands of these, several things. First of all, people do not understand how talented they are. They don't understand the gifts they have, because things that come naturally to us, we don't see that they're special.
Mm.
Like, you have a beautiful voice, and you know how to help people use their voice. To someone else, that's unbelievable. What a gift from heaven. So number one, we don't really understand ourselves. Number two, the other thing is, I call it essence versus form. People know how to fantasize about something. I want to be a singer in the band. Yeah. I want to run a bed and breakfast. I want to write a book. I want to sail around the world. But they really don't understand the process required to create the right form of work for them that is going to honor the essence that they want. So when we dig deep, often, you know, let's say someone wants to start a bed and breakfast, they have to go and research what would that be like. They come back and say, oh my goodness, I don't want to run a bed and breakfast. Mm-hmm. What I really want is to create experiences for people through this, right? So the reinvention part is hard because you've got to know yourself. And then through a process of steps, you have to figure out what is truly the direction that's going to marry up everything I've ever been, in a way that's going to meet my financial and other needs. But there is a process, and I teach that process. But you do have to take the right steps. If you don't, you're going to blow it. And I've blown it.
Yeah. You scratch the surface and you think you've got it. And then you spend all this time and energy, and that wasn't, you were chasing the wrong.
I mean, just briefly, nothing's a quick answer with me, is it?
I know, it's great.
When I became a therapist, I talk about this in a video, there's something called the pendulum effect. When people are in pain in their work, they want to run as far away from it as possible. So for me, when I got laid off, I said, I never want to step foot in a corporate office again. I never want to wear a suit. I never want to do any of it. So therapy seemed the farthest end of the world. The problem is, if you don't shift yourself internally now, 5 years later, the same toxic challenges that you had there will appear. And people don't want to hear that. They come to the Amazing Career Project and they want to run. Mm. And I'll make them not run. And I say, we have to improve what you have this minute. And I promise you, when you do that, what you're energetically able to connect with and attract in 6 months is so different. So as a therapist, you know, I worked with rape, incest, pedophilia, drug addiction, suicidality. And 5 years I did this. And all along, I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. And one day a client called up and said, I'm going to kill myself now. I'm going to wrap my car around a tree. And I knew in that moment, I don't want this.
Yeah.
I snapped out of it. We got her help. She's doing much better. But I told my husband, I don't want to be a therapist after 5 years and a master's and $30,000 later.
Wow.
So that's why I'm so passionate to help people do it the right way.
So let me ask you this. I've heard you talk about so many things, but I've heard you talk about how we get in our own way. What are the main ways women do this?
So, you know, there's five that I can think of, but I think there's 500, you know, particularly with women, but men are known to do this. There's something I call perfectionistic overfunctioning. And I learned this term overfunctioning in therapy. Overfunctioning is doing more than is necessary, more than is appropriate, and more than is healthy. When you add the perfectionistic layer to it, now you're doing everything and wanting to get an A in it all. And so many, almost every woman who comes to me for help is a perfectionistic overfunctioner. Why? Because great achievers in this world have often been overfunctioners. The problem is, at a certain point, it'll break you down. You'll collapse. You just can't keep going, especially when you have children, because now you're trying to be perfect at work and perfect at home, and you're killing yourself. So you know, how do we get over this? Stop trying to be perfect. Choose the things that you can't live without, those non-negotiables that, you know, if you go to your grave and you didn't do that well, like for me, that was parenting. I wanted to be in the fabric of my children's lives. And I knew I wasn't going to take a very senior role that wouldn't let me do that. And I was fine with that decision. Decide what you can let go of and stop trying to be everything to everyone. You're not going to succeed and you're going to just crush yourself. The second is boundaries. And again, I learned this in therapy training. I think one of the most important concepts I've ever learned in my life. Boundaries are the invisible barrier between you and your outside systems, you and your spouse, you and your church or synagogue, you and your work. And the way you look at boundaries that can be helpful is it's on a scale, kind of a gradient on, and boundaries kind of impact, regulate the flow of information and input from you and your systems. So on the one hand, if you're very disconnected, like how many people do we know don't even know the internal life of their children? They're just focused on themselves. So that's disengaged, right? They're rigid boundaries. Nothing's getting in.
Yeah.
On the other side, it's, this is what I see much more of, completely diffuse boundaries. Everything is getting in. You don't know where you end and other people begin. Mm. And I see a lot of parents who are enmeshed with their children. I was enmeshed with my mom. But if you, and this is all about speaking up, literally and figuratively, if you don't know where you end and someone else begins, you're almost not even able to understand what you believe because you're so worried about how they're going to experience it. You know, when you let them down, you're not living your own life.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to form very powerful boundaries. And when we do that, sometimes it upsets the whole system. People are used to us being pushovers. People are used to, well, Kathy will do it. She does everything.
Mm.
No, I mean, I remember the first time I learned this and started having to say, no, I actually won't do that. People are like, what happened to her? She used to be so, so boundaries. The third way we get in our way is refusing to speak up and stand up for what we want. You know, so many women say, I really want a raise at work, or I really deserve more. I deserve that project. Okay. What did you say about it? Did you go to your boss? Did you build a case? You can't just sit alone in your own head and say what you deserve. You have to fight for it. The fourth is saying yes to things that you should say no to, which is a little like boundaries. Everything you say yes to is saying no to something else. So you really have to understand, what am I going to focus my time on here? Like even in your own business, I did an interview with someone on my Forbes blog about the vital few. So many people focus on the trivial many, all the little shiny objects, you know, even for business. What you have to figure out, what we have to figure out, is what are the three things I have to do this week, this month? I mean, we have to truly move us forward and say yes to that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say, here's another thing that women do that get stand in their way. They hurt other women.
Mm. Yes.
I still see it. It just came out, a podcast with Dr. Lucy Gilson, my Best Work, Best Life podcast with Coach Mo Fall. And we interviewed Dr. Lucy Gilson, who is a PhD and department head of management at UConn, University of Connecticut. And we were talking about why is it that women are so hard on women. And you know what she said that I'd never thought of? Women scrutinize in a very difficult, challenging, biting way often other women. But now that we are 100% all the time connected to each other online, the scrutiny is constant.
Mm.
The bashing is constant. The saying she's fat online, or, you know, it's ever present. And I never thought of that before. So I'm going to give this piece of advice. Every word that comes out of your mouth is either a weapon, right? Or a blessing. And you're also either blessing yourself or hurting yourself. Every word that you share about someone else will come back. I mean, I've learned this in scary ways. Like I said some nasty thing about my next door neighbor, about something with their child. I'm not kidding. 24 hours later, that same thing, it was about failing a test, happened to my kid.
Wow.
It is a weapon. What? Yeah. Right? And you talk about this, I'm sure.
Oh, I do. I say, you know, of course, I believe the voice is the most vulnerable tool, the most powerful tool, and it can do one of two things. It can wound or it can empower. Mm-hmm. And it's just that simple.
It is really that simple. But the piece to that, I know you do talk about, you can't bifurcate what you're saying about others to what you're saying about yourself.
Oh, you better
believe
it.
And a lot of people, you know, they're so cruel. And then they wonder why they're not happy.
Yeah.
Because cruelty doesn't make you happy. It might for a moment, you know how blame for a moment takes away our anxiety for a total split second. Yeah, well, then you've got the pain of what you just did.
We cannot judge and compare trauma. So let's talk about trauma.
So my wise husband once told me that your worst day is your worst day. It doesn't matter what the circumstances were. Everyone's entitled to their worst day. And so what he meant by that was we can't compare trauma, can't compare experiences. When we do that, we limit ourselves from getting the help that we need. Because my trauma is not big enough. It's not gnarly enough, even though it's impacting you on a daily basis. And so that's exactly the case. We have been taught to minimize emotions. We've been taught to minimize the impact of trauma. And so as a society, we barely allow people to have the big T trauma, which is what you're talking about, like PTSD, the big stuff. We barely let people have that. We certainly are not letting people have what we call small T trauma or complex trauma, which are harder to define. They're more of those cumulative chronic experiences that we've had over our childhood that changed who we were moment by moment rather than one big catastrophic event. And so a lot of people will just say, well, I had a bad childhood. They don't think they have trauma.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I had a screwed up family. They don't think they have trauma. And so they are not calling a thing, which is like my mantra right now. Call a thing, it is trauma. And once you can recognize that, then you can get the appropriate assistance and support for it. And most of the time, people are relieved when they find out that what they're experiencing that has created the patterns in their life is trauma. They're like, oh, okay, so I'm just not crazy. No, you got traumatized and you're recreating it now. And you cannot do that if you learn a few things to change. So it is a big deal. We don't let people have their trauma.
Well, and put it in perspective, people, listeners, think about this. In my work, one phrase when you're five of being told to shut up can lock your voice down for the rest of your life. So think about that. And that really, to me, drives home what you're talking about, Nicole, is that we think that trauma has to be these huge things. But I don't know, is there anybody on earth that doesn't have trauma?
I don't think so. I've yet to meet anyone that doesn't have some form of trauma. I mean, when you think about birth is pretty traumatic.
Yeah.
In a way. But yeah, we just don't see it that way. It's the wearing down over time, or it's the big explosion. Either way, it still impacts who we are, what we believe to be true about ourselves, and what's possible for us. And that changes everything.
Yeah. And I think that trauma's got to be keeping people from using their voices, that it's all got to be intertwined. It goes back to that rubber band ball that, well, I have this trauma, whether I'm even recognizing it as trauma or not, might even be unspoken. I might not even be unaware of it. But does that then link to worth, which then links to my voice doesn't matter? I see it as yes. What are your thoughts on that? Michelle, what do you think about that?
I think you nailed it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's the short answer. I'm thinking that voice voice is something that we think very specifically comes out of our mouth, but it comes out of every part of us.
Yeah.
It comes out in our appearance. It comes out in our creativity. It comes out in our writing. It comes out in our art. It comes out in our job choices, our relationship choices. Our voice is so much more than the timbres in our throats, or you know the technical stuff. I don't know. But when I first started really trying to use my voice, it didn't come out of my mouth. It came through my fingertips. It came through writing. It came through writing the pain or the fear or the crazy ass dream that I didn't understand was happening. Mm-hmm. It came through writing about the experiences. And that is how I used to find my voice. That was the tool to figure out what it is that I'm trying to say, why I'm on this planet at this time and in this space. What is this message that I've been given? Every being has a message that they've been given to share. And when we have experienced a trauma at a young age, at a slightly older age, and on and on and on, it's like a shift in our trajectory, right? It's like this little speed bump that says, oh, no, you can't say that right now. Maybe try to say something else. But no, that something else is not the message that I've been given. So I might dabble on this side and think, okay, well, maybe I'm supposed to be saying something else, but it's not true. It doesn't feel like authentic. It doesn't ring every fiber of my being because it's not my truth. You have to be able to speak your truth. It doesn't have to look like anybody else's. Nobody else even has to understand it, to be honest. It's your truth. It's your voice. It's your story. You are put here to live it in all those ways, out of your mouth, through your hands, how you show up in this world. And that's your gift, is your message. It's your voice.
The next thing I do with my clients is also make sure that we talk about what are some of your responses to some of the frequently asked questions. And so there are questions that we all know get asked during interviews. Tell me about yourself. What's your strength? What's your weakness? But questions like that where we feel like we may know them, but if you don't start thinking about what is it that you want to actually say, it's so much harder to just communicate it on the spot. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing that I actually have my clients do is practice and actually simulate the experience with them. So many people are in their heads and think,
my audience, sorry, I have to pause right there. My audience is like, oh gosh, no wonder she brought her on this show. That up in the head thing again. Okay, keep going.
It's so true. It's because people think, I know my life. I know the experiences that I've had. I can say this at the drop of a hat and it'll come out just flawlessly. And that's very rarely the case. If you haven't at least practiced how you want to say it, received some constructive feedback about how it was received by the person who was hearing it, you oftentimes are flying blind. You don't even know whether or not what you said hit the mark, whether or not what you said resonated with somebody, whether or not it confused that person. And so simulating with my clients is something that's really important for them to walk into that interview feeling much more confident.
I promise you guys, I did not tell her to say all of that before we got, I've never even heard her talk about this, but it is so lined up. That is it. It's, you're so connected up into your head that you forget that what you perceive you're doing is not what we're receiving. And I talk about that ad nauseum in voice, but here you go talking about that is one of the biggest problems in interviewing. I love what you said about the core message and centering everything around who you are and what you know, it kind of lines up with that. It really does line up with what you do with the college students. Who are you? What is your unique thing that you bring to the table? And I love that you kind of run them through mock scenarios. I think I've heard you mention, we've talked about body language. You help people with their body language in these interviews as well, right?
Yes. Yeah. So much of what you communicate is, yes, the words that you say, but also how you say it. What is your facial expression as you're saying it? What are your hand gestures? A lot of times people aren't aware of it. You know, I'm reflecting back on some of the interviews that I've had with folks where there was someone who was speaking too much with their hands And they didn't realize it. It was just so distracting for folks, where when that person walked out, one of my colleagues said, I was afraid they were going to knock over the coffee because they kept moving their hands so violently. And that candidate probably was nervous, I'm guessing. And I don't know if that's how they talk normally, but it was a distraction for the interviewer. And as a panel, what you want to make sure of is that they don't get distracted by any of that. You want them to hear you. You want them to process what it is that you're saying and communicating. And you want as much as possible to minimize all of those distractions that can get in the way of the message that you're trying to convey.
Let me ask you a question, because that was really good. Of course, I am all about that, but it made me think of something. When I coach people on their voices, one of the things that I talk to people about, they're up in their head and they're not sounding conversational and they're focused on the words. And I say, what do you want? I'm your audience. What do you want me to feel? And it made me think about this when you were just saying this. Is it almost like people that are interviewing get really bogged down in what do they want me to deliver? What do they want me to deliver versus, you know, so it's almost like this game of let me try to give them what they want, even though I don't know what they want, rather than let me reveal who I am and build a relationship almost. Does that make sense? Does that question make sense?
It totally makes sense. And I think that's where a lot of candidates miss the mark. So if they actually have made it into the interview, that means that you have made it through the first pass on paper. You've made the group think that you are going to be a good fit. But once you're actually in that conversation, people forget it's a two-way conversation. It's about determining mutual fit for a company or a mutual fit for a role. And oftentimes interviewees are so preoccupied with trying to impress the interview panel or the interviewer that they sometimes forget to create that time and space so that there can be reflection, so that there could be a two-way conversation. And sometimes, and I felt this sometimes when I'm interviewing someone, they don't give me a moment to actually ask a question because they're speaking so much and so fast, and or they may have lost their train of thought, but they just kept on talking and didn't give themselves a moment to center themselves and figure out where do they want to go. And those are all distractions, right? It takes away from the core message that that person is probably trying to convey. You know, I recently interviewed a candidate who was brilliant. She had great credentials, had wonderful experience, and she had a major issue with talking so fast and trying to deliver so much content in every breath that she said. While, you know, it was pretty in terms of technicality, it was done pretty well in terms of no ums, uhs, likes, or you knows, no word weeds or anything. But because she spoke so quickly, I was able to keep up with what she was saying, but some of my colleagues were really distracted by that pace and couldn't process whether or not she was communicating the way in which that would resonate for the company. Mm-hmm. And so I recall, and this is again behind the scenes, I recall after that candidate walked out, there was two observations made by my fellow panelists. One was he said he started counting how many times she took a breath, because he wasn't sure whether or not she was actually pausing. So he found himself distracted and seeing, is she actually breathing in between each of her responses? And another panelist had mentioned, he noticed that she opened a bottle of water and was waiting for her to take a sip of it so she could just pause. But she opened the bottle of water and never drank it. And so that was also a distraction for him, that he was waiting for her to pause so that he can actually ask a question back. And so I think that those times are when candidates get so nervous, so in their head about what it is they want to communicate, that they forget that it's a two-way conversation. And being able to flex that conversation, take that person along with you in this journey and this conversation together, is what an interview really is. It's not just line listing all sorts of things about you. Otherwise, you could have just submitted a video resume and could have accomplished the same thing.
Wow, such great memories from having all of these amazing women on the show. It was really hard to pick. I've loved every guest I've ever had on the show, but these were exceptionally special and I wanted to bring them back for a revisit. So I hope you enjoyed hearing from these women, but I'm going to wrap it up. That's it for today's episode. So until I see you next time, you know what to do. Get out there and speak your truth. Just do it beautifully.
Thanks for listening to Captivate the Room with Tracy Goodwin. You can reach out to her at captivatetheroom.com and be sure to grab the Voice Formula, a free video series that will help you start making a bigger impact with your voice today. If you've enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on iTunes.